Good evening. This is Circe again with another Brat Time story. Tonight, I am going to read the boyhood memories of Paul Zobrod. He's a Korean War veteran, and he's remembering growing up during World War II. His story is titled, How a Unified Nation Fights a Good War. My recollections of World War II contrast starkly with today's so-called war on COVID-19. Starting with the surprise December 7th Pearl Harbor raid, 3 days before my 9th birthday, an early memory reminds me of the trust we kids had in the adults in our lives. The memory of my father's voice as he crossed the field to a slope's foot where my brother and I were sledding with Tommy McDowell and two other pals, he had come to tell us Japan had just attacked. We were at war. We stopped our play and circled around him, all five of us. We imagined scenes from the British movie Mrs. Miniver with its images of falling bombs rattling buildings and frightening little kids out of their sleep. Dad paused as we settled ourselves on the side of our sleds and eyeballed us. Soft-spoken and deliberate in speech with his lingering Yiddish accent, he waited until we were still. He looked grave but composed, our eyes fixed on his quiet face. "Don't worry, boys," he finally said. "We'll all be safe." He gave us a confident smile. Like so many in our working-class neighborhood, he was an immigrant who'd known hunger and uncertainty. He was confident now with that behind him. "This is a great country. We'll win the war, all right. You kids go ahead and have fun." Then he turned and started back home. But instead of resuming our sledding, we stayed locked in that circle and talked kids' talk about how we'd beat the Japanese, about whose dads and uncles and big brothers would be going off to war, about how maybe we'd get to fight someday. We talked about it on the way to school the next morning and throughout the schoolhouse day, buoyed by how my dad's confidence meshed with that of our teachers and of our principal, Mr. Moore. We talked about it over the family dinner, and while listening after leaving the table to President Roosevelt's earlier radio comments rebroadcast on the evening news. By bedtime, we could sleep peacefully, reassured all the more by our parents' trust in him. I still remember the sound of his commanding voice. I watched the world change, and changed with it. Dads, uncles, older brothers, and neighbors offered us boys a nickel to search for named mails listed in post offices and on storefronts, each with a corresponding draft board number. I found my uncle's. He was living with us and still young enough to be inducted. I found my father's. He was too old for active duty, but required to leave his freight yard job and work instead at American Bridge, making vessels for landing tanks and troops on beachheads. I found our next-door neighbor, Mr. Acuries. He was also too old for induction, but ordered to stay on at the steel mill where he worked. We kids found ourselves participating in a grand-scale national mission. We went door-to-door collecting scrap metal to carry to collection centers at local schools, and for that we were given quarters to buy defense stamps. Fill a book worth $18.75 and get a bond redeemable in 10 years for $25. It took money to fight a war, and we could help finance it. With our parents, we trolleyed downtown to Pittsburgh's Baltimore and Ohio Station to say goodbye to inductees boarding trains for active duty. As a band played and wives and sweethearts kissed their men goodbye, we boys ran up to recruits to shake hands and wish them luck. It was our war, too. If 10 or older, you could volunteer to be a junior air raid warden and tag along down darkened streets with an elder. Once the siren sounded, you could blow a police whistle if any glimmer of light escaped through windows blackened by light-proof blinds that were required in every home. Come spring, we planted seeds in schoolyard victory gardens, and during summer vacation, we pulled weeds and picked crops to be distributed. Every Wednesday during school's last hour, we wrote letters to soldiers and sailors. Not relatives, just uniformed men and women we didn't know. Another way to learn grammar while boosting the war effort, teachers told us. War taught us geography. Teachers pointed to a map, and the world expanded before our eyes. Here's Hawaii. There are the Philippines and Bataan, where the death march started. There's England. There's France. Over here's Poland. There's Germany. Here's Japan. Ours was a country among other countries, divided into axes and allies. That knowledge supplemented reading newspapers, watching movies, listening to the radio programs, paging through Life magazine with its grand photos. By my 11th birthday, I was delivering the Daily Pittsburgh Press and hawking it on street corners for added war stamp money. Shouted headlines, "Allies hit the beaches at Normandy, Paris liberated." Just as Dad predicted, we were winning. It happened as if naturally, like going to bed a juvenile and waking to puberty. Even before tackling those more grown-up responsibility, we sacrificed things we had enjoyed as little kids. No more cast iron toy cars, no lead soldiers, cap guns, all gone. Metal squirt guns, gone. At school, one paper towel had to last all day. We went without chewing gum, lifesavers, Hershey bars, all being shipped to military posts. Grown-ups sacrificed too. Cigarettes were scarce, a national speed limit of 35 miles per hour. Train travel was prioritized. Rosie the Riveter became a female civilian role model, minus nylons and favorite cosmetics. Glamour went military with pinup posters of Betty Grable and Rita Hayworth. They were relegated to barracks, ships, planes, and helmet liners at the front. Letters to and from the front were censored. Movement back and forth at home was closely monitored to prevent espionage, a real danger. Constitutional rights were never invoked in protests that I recall. The public complied. There were complaints, of course. One wartime or other domestic policy might be questioned, but never resisted. Universal trust circulated in the air we breathed, in everyday conversation, on the radio, in the songs we sang and danced to. Don't sit under the apple tree, or praise the Lord and pass the ammunition, or coming in on a wing or a prayer, or I'll be seeing you. Solidarity materialized everywhere. You want an example? Google a short movie making the rounds of neighborhood theaters back then. The House I Live In, where Frank Sinatra sings the title song to denounce prejudice. Flaws and fault lines in civic life could wait till the war's end. It was a time of coordinated solidarity. Coordinated how? By focused leadership under a president and a cabinet with national backing. By shared confidence in a federal government whose separate states need not act alone. By a network of federal agencies so fully staffed and tightly spun that only now do I appreciate how comprehensively planned and strategically led a government can operate in the face of crisis. All behind the aegis of federalism armed to enable the separate states to rally together. Consider this. On December 7, 1941, Japan attacked, just about when last December the corona pandemic first gained attention. In less time then that it's taking now to come up with a national testing plan, a well-conceived war effort emerged. As if at once, draft boards nationwide posted men's names and each one's draft status. By January, an appointed war production board put factories to work in the nation's defense. By February, households were sending boys off to war en masse. Tanks and planes were rolling off of Detroit assembly lines as families began to manage with their old cars and make repairs with used parts. A plan organized from Washington that included Chinese cooperation led to a surprise bombing run over Tokyo on April 18th. A comprehensive framework for rationing was in place by May. By June 4th, the Pacific War's tide already began turning with an Allied victory at the Battle of Midway. Already, with the American fleet still reeling from the raid on Pearl Harbor, American intelligence managed to break the Japanese naval code. By then, my schoolmates and I could follow events for ourselves. With broadening awareness, we discovered how the country had begun to prime for the war prior to Pearl Harbor Day. Roosevelt initiated the Manhattan Project in 1939. Congress legislated a draft board in 1941. The raid on Pearl Harbor may have taken the nation by surprise, but advanced preparations were implemented, not ignored or abandoned. In our youth, we got to take executive poise and disciplined intergovernmental cooperation for granted. States did not raise their own volunteer armies or set their own speed limits. Rationing was a national policy. Households did not themselves decide how to sequester right during an air raid. We did not witness armed resistance to being told what to do on the steps of state capitals. Instead, we joined in as a strong nation's wave of trust took it across two oceans to victory, three continents away. It was a good time to grow up. I recognize these as boyhood memories, lacking the nuance experience brings. With my military service and education, I can now regard this country more objectively, better aware of its uniquely flawed history and every government's shortcomings. But my father's Pearl Harbor Day reassurance, reinforced by my growing trust in national purpose, fed my childhood. It remains part of my upbringing. Dare I say ours? It's in our DNA. It accompanied me during my Army years as the Korean War ended and the one in Vietnam began to simmer. It informed my parenting and teaching years as I sought to transmit it proudly as a first-generation beneficiary of the American dream. How and why that trust has eroded, I leave historians to determine. Maybe fighting a Cold War was somehow different. Maybe trust began to fester in Indochina. Maybe we grew soft with post-war prosperity. Maybe we overdosed on a digitally driven convenience. But fate it did, which saddens me now. Raised on trust, nourished by the full embrace of the war's sacrifice and austerity in the wake of the Great Depression's poverty, I grew up among role models who defined my formative years, starting with my father and other close relatives, my neighbors and teachers, all the way to far-off giants like President Roosevelt, Generals Douglas MacArthur, George Marshall, and Dwight Eisenhower himself. This leaves me to wonder who today's young kids will emulate and how will they turn out under the shadow of generations raised to believe the government is untrustworthy in a world polarized by wealth inequality and a global environment at risk. This essay reminds me of how much trust I had in the adults in my life, and I wonder if there was a role model that you can think of fondly tonight. Also, as we are in this COVID pandemic, what history will you write to explain to further generations of what you experienced, of what your family sacrificed for this national catastrophe? So, until next time, I wish you good health and good rest.